The inescapable reality was that the CPA was ineptly organized and frequently incompetent, working badly not only with Iraqis, but even with the U.S. military, its partner in the occupation. There are different points of view on almost any issue in Iraq, but there is surprising unanimity from both sides of the fence that the relationship between the CPA and the military began badly and deteriorated further with time. Sherry Cram said the CPA-military relationship was very poor. She explained, "I don't think we spoke the same language." "The CPA, what a dysfunctional arrangement that was," exclaimed Major General John Batiste, who commanded the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq in 2004 and 5. "It was nuts." A general who served in Iraq went even further, saying that the occupation authority was the single greatest asset the enemy had. Fundamentally, the CPA and the military had different conceptions of what the United States was doing in Iraq. The civilians, more in line with Bush administration thinking about transforming Iraq and the region, implemented policies that set out to change the politics, economy, and even the culture of Iraq. The military, less culturally sympathetic to the administration's revolutionary goals, thought of its mission as almost the opposite, calling it stability and security operations. The military was there to win the conflict, find Saddam, and then keep the peace, retired Rear Admiral David Oliver, a veteran submarine officer and an astute analyst of the politics of defense, wrote later in a short memoir of his time devising the CPA's budget. After the war, the military sought to keep the population quiet, while the CPA focused on change, which meant that it was bound to provoke vocal and violent reactions from some Iraqis opposed to those changes. For example, Oliver noted, as the CPA was seeking to normalize commerce by opening banks, which would reassure merchants that they could conduct business without fear of being robbed of the cash they had to keep on hand, some U.S. commanders were walking into banks and demanding piles of cash from government payrolls to pay for local cleanup projects. Outfitting Iraqi police was another of those points of friction that emerged. "They were useless," Lieutenant Colonel Poirier, who was trying to set up police forces in Tikrit and Samarra, recalled. "The guidance from them changed daily. Get the police white uniforms, then no, get blue uniforms." The CPA public affairs operation also underwhelmed some colleagues. "At one meeting, I was awestruck by the superficiality of the insights that they brought to the table. Absolutely awestruck," recalled Larry Crandall, a CPA official involved in Reconstruction financing. The military's discord with the CPA even reached down to the small unit level. "My relationship with the CPA as an infantry commander has been tenuous at best," one company commander in the 101st Airborne wrote in his response to an official army survey. "First, their guidance has been contradictory at times with the military and definitely not well coordinated. Also," he said, "the civilian administrators violated the basic principle of unity of effort. CPA officials arrived in our AO, area of operations, and conducted meetings and conferences, made promises to local officials that were contradictory to past military-to-local official meetings and/or agreements." With the passage of time, the CPA and the U.S. military acted less like partners and more like adversaries. Soldiers blamed civilians for not rebuilding the country quickly enough to pacify the country, while civilians blamed the military for not providing enough security to enable the rebuilding, the Washington Post's Rajiv Chandrasekharan would later write in summarizing this unhappy relationship. The backdrop to that tension in Iraq was a larger strategic disconnect that was even more troubling. The Bush administration had extraordinary ambitions for Iraq, and indeed for the entire Mideast, but it declined for months to provide the resources needed to fulfill that vision. Partly because Wolfowitz and others had said that Iraqi reconstruction would be largely self-financing. By the end of the summer, it was clear that the reconstruction effort was stalling and that restarting it would take far more money than had been contemplated by the U.S. government. On Bremer's desk was a sign that nobly stated, "Success has 1,000 fathers." Sir Jeremy Greenstock, the veteran diplomat who was Bremer's top British aide, later commented that he should have replaced it with the message, "Security and jobs, stupid." The Bush administration would come to agree with that sentiment in private, and asked Congress for a huge supplemental spending bill, $87 billion, to get the effort going. But even then, the wheels of the CPA bureaucracy turned so slowly that it took months to get basic equipment such as flak jackets to Iraqi security forces being trained by the U.S. government. The cumulative result of this incompetence was that by the late fall of 2003, the U.S. occupation of Iraq began to lose its claim on the lukewarm middle of Iraqi public opinion in a poll of 1,167 Iraqis conducted for the CPA in five cities in November and December 2003. 62% said that security was the most urgent issue facing them. U.S. has credibility problem, reported one slide on the survey, because 59% of those polled said the United States would leave Iraq only when forced to. The United States hadn't yet lost Iraq, but the trends were heading that way.